Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It is July 10th, 2017, 7102017, which backwards is 7102017.
Oh my god.
The date is the same.
Yes.
The date is the same.
Palindrome
Waypoint
day.
Radio is here to tell you the date is a palindrome today. Welcome to Palindrome Day if you were in North America, presumably. I guess Europe does it the other way. In Europe today is like 1072017, which is not a palindrome.
That's nowhere near as fun.
No. What if they reversed the year also, and then the year was...
Oh, if they put the year first.
Yeah, they did. I don't know. Maybe that would be a whole different thing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It is episode 78 of Waypoint Radio. Joining me today, Danielle Riendo, here in Lobby 1 in Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah, Brooklyn.
Also calling in from Boston, Robert Zachney.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, Rob, can you actually, like, pay attention, or are you just neck deep in the subterfuge game today? You can't actually... How
can't
often are you
going
to check your phone?
So I might have to tune out from time to time, because right now my phone is blinking and it says I have 17 messages.
Wow.
Which could be a lot of things. Probably none of them good. Right now, our friend Nick Capizzole is...
Waypoint freelancer.
Yeah, good guy, but apparently just a loathsome subterfuge player.
Yeah, I would never play that game with him. We'll talk about subterfuge a little later in the show. We'll wrap back around to what that is. It's a wild ride. I'll never play it again. Patrick Klepek also joining us from Chicago. How you doing, Patrick?
I feel like we should put like a if I could somehow take my Nest camera that is on my daughter right now,
yes,
who's home from daycare because she has a fever from teething, and daycare can't give kids medicine, so I had to bring this kid home.
That's a legal thing.
Now she's sleeping. It's like a legal thing.
That makes sense.
Even though it's just Tylenol, they're not authorized to give random kids medication, which makes sense.
Yeah.
But it
you
also
can draw
means,
a line
like,
somewhere in there.
It
no
also
baths,
means
no
like
medicine.
She's totally fine and I shouldn't have had to interrupt my work day to go get her, but that's just the policy. So if I have like my Nest cam in the corner that's like, when this thing stirs, then Patrick has to leave the podcast. But who knows when that'll happen?
That's
Sometimes
who knows. Can we get
3 hours.
Actually, can we get that Nest camera pointed at Rob's phone so that we know when his underwater submarine bases are being invaded? That'd be cool.
Is she playing the game? This is like the highest level. Be a baby.
Shit. All right.
Be a baby, number one.
Step one, be a baby.
Have teething.
That's most of the internet.
Well, your fake thing is like when I've played subterfuge with people, they might fake teething. Like, oh, I got to go home from daycare today, I got to look at my phone all day,
That's
so I can sneak attack Austin. Fucking son.
That's what she's doing.
Subterfuge is most of being a baby. Like,
in general.
Speaking. Yeah.
Like making allegiances and breaking them, and just seeing how far you can push your borders.
They're trying to mess up their own lives. It's not even just like they're playing a game in which they're trying to screw with you. It's like, I'm going to walk off this ledge because I don't understand how gravity and elevation works. Like, whoops! Like, I've just fallen down 6 steps. That hasn't happened. I'm not saying my kid fell down 6 steps. I'm just saying you spend your life preventing them
totally
from falling down 6 steps.
God. Speaking of people who are trying to prevent people from falling down six steps, speaking of, like, having what sometimes feels like a paternal instinct, there was a video going around this weekend that made me feel just like a general, like, I wish I could direct the discourse. I feel like I wish I could help the discourse grow up. I feel like the discourse has been in a
fallen down some stairs
and
lately.
Has been in the childish state forever. Dunkey, who is a YouTube, this is like, I was just gonna dive into this because this is like the
Let's
topic du jour. Actually, the topic du jour is we're all dying from global warming,
that
and
too.
Also Donald
Jesus
Trump Jr.
Christ.
Is
we're all
that's
dying.
The discourse today, but I'm gonna hang on to the last little bit of the wave of Dunkey discourse.
Yes,
which
the
is actually
DD.
I think Dunkey should have a new side channel on YouTube. It's just called Dunky Discourse. Get another 2 or 3 million subscribers. For people who don't know, I guess Patrick or Danielle. Danielle, you know Dunky stuff. So like, can you introduce for listeners who might not know who Dunky is?
Sure. So he has like sort of a comedic YouTube channel. He plays a game and, you know, either does like a 6 to 20 to, I guess there are some longer forms of it. And sort of criticizes a game, but is also like very humorous about it. He makes a lot of jokes. He does a lot of dunks. I think that's probably where it came from. I don't know that for a fact. This is me trying to figure all these things out as I go.
Right.
He has said some very problematic things in the past, but I generally really actually like his channel. I think he actually says a lot of really, really smart things. His ukulele video was amazing. He sort of set out like, oh, I was trying to have fun with this, but you know, what actual great game design in Banjo-Kazooie and Banjo-Tooie is not present here. They really sort of screwed up in certain ways. And does it in like this really humorous and really sort of fast-cutting and like fun kind of way.
Right. So like it gets the format of YouTube, understands like what appeals to that audience.
Makes everything very palatable. Right. Yeah.
And then this weekend, he put out a video. It was on July 8th called Game Critics. That's it. Just Game Critics.
That's what it was.
And it's like a 9-minute long video that is a kind of a scattered shot attempt to like give his thoughts about the state of games reviews and games criticism in general. I guess like the most generous way I can talk about it is to say he thinks that game criticism is at its best when it informs a reader about a purchasing decision and about like the quality of a game, and that it when it's at its very highest, it's coming from someone who has a unified voice, a cohesive voice that reflects a long established context of previous reviews, a sort of cohesive body of work that lets you know what their subjective understanding of their taste is. Like what, you know, here, this is the type of person, like his example for himself is, I don't like JRPGs, therefore you know that when I like a JRPG, I must really like it.
Special.
It's something special.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And that he has issue with major outlets, the IGNs, the GameSpots, the Polygons, who have a great deal of reviewers whose subjective tastes do not align. They don't form a cohesive whole. They don't reflect like, hey, this reviewer is defending Sonic and these other five people are dunking on Sonic nonstop. And then also that the scoring systems, you know, everyone uses 7 to 10 and also like vague allegations of pay for play of just like, oh, I think it's because you maybe not pay for play, but there's a cushy relationship.
None of that happens on YouTube.
Right.
Yeah, well, right.
I mean, like, first, I mean, for me, like, one of my first thoughts was like, dog, you're on like a multi-channel network owned by Curse, which is owned by Amazon. They're owned by Twitch, which is owned by Amazon. So, like, at the very beginning, like, let's just like tone that part of it down a little bit because not an accusation here, but like, everybody's in the fucking pocket of some big business at this point. Like,
making money
if you're
on
making
the internet
money
is a deeply complicated
and convoluted
set
and
of great levels
compromise.
Of gray in which you have to sort of like settle on what can you accept while not wholly losing your soul in the process.
Right, exactly. Like it's one of those things where like I want to recognize that there are lots of incredible independent creators on YouTube, but also a lot of them are part of networks that are owned by major media corporations like Disney and Amazon. So like
it's part
if you're
of
not
a platform,
on a Patreon,
right? YouTube is a platform in the same way that IGN and GameSpot are platforms for like a series of writers that do their own individual work where, you know, not that the YouTube to IGN analogy like completely holds, but like you don't judge one video on YouTube as all of YouTube's opinion on something. Like you end up drilling down in the same way that you drill down with a platform like an IGN or a GameSpot. Like they these days, like IGN and GameSpot are as personality based as YouTube is, where like what, you know, no one really cares these days what outlet I write for. I mean, they do in like a sense that like, oh, I'm excited that Patrick's going to work with Austin.
You
and
definitely
Danielle
stopped
and
getting Hulk Hogan jokes sent at you when you. I'm not firing shots about that. You know what side of that shit I was on. You know, like, but like people care enough to reframe their arguments around stuff and stuff like
they
that.
They do, but at the same time, like these days, like if I was to go somewhere else, like they like. A certain audience follows, like the audience that cares about what you have to say, they follow you to the next thing through social networks like Twitter and Facebook and other things like that. And so these like these centralized IGNs and GameSpots have like decentralized writers that are disconnected from the economic hub that allows them to like pay their rent and buy food and publish for a living.
Right. And like have a legal team to help prevent takedowns of videos and have, you know, an HR department so that if there's a problem in the office, they like this is part of why you go to work at a company.
There
are certain assurances that like, hey, if the company is in the tank this month, you're still going to get your paycheck, even if the ad rates on YouTube changed or whatever. Right. Like this is the trade-off that you make when you stop being independent and go to work at a major company that can give you those assurances, those insurances in a sense.
Yes.
And the thing that ended up being like – it's a video that I think caused a lot of response partially because it targets writers because writers have names and at the same time almost insinuates that it also – undermines the notion that writers are individuals. Like that's the thing that's so tricky about it, so frustrating for me about it, because there's a bit where he puts 37 names on screen. They're like the 37 reviewers that IGN has used over the last year, many of which are freelancers, which means like those are not salaried individuals who have access to an HR department and who have healthcare through IGN. Those are people who are like hustling for a few hundred dollars here or there. And like get put on blast for not being in line about what they said about Sonic with like what Arthur Geese said about Sonic while he was briefly at IGN 5 years ago or whatever, right? And so like that part of it was really frustrating. And it felt like there was a disconnect between I don't like this thing that is true about the nature of game reviews in 2017. And he was making that case by insulting individual writers. And that was like that's the part that frustrated me so much.
Yeah.
But I guess generally I'm curious what people thought about his overall position on the state of games reviews and like whether or not this is just the same argument I've heard for the last 20 years in this space. Like since when, you know, CGW got rid of review scores for a hot second when I was in high school or whatever.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Back when it was novel.
Right. Yeah. I was like, what is the tone to this response here? Like, do people have grievances they want to air? Is this just like another bump in the road?
Well, I was going to say, like, to go back to an earlier point, part of my issue with the video is its inability, like, it paints game critics as an outside thing as opposed to something that a donkey is a part of. I think that, like some of the extreme reaction, not I mean, extreme is the wrong word, but like some of part of the reason some people would take issue with a video like this is because, you know, there's a growing sort of like videos becoming more important and like some people are specialized in writing and like there's a lot of larger economic issues as that transition takes place and some people's skills don't maybe transfer to video. And so this idea that like video is becoming the de facto sort of like criticism or method of criticism like creates like a tension and then there's a separation between like, if you read coverage of folks that make like coverage on traditional gaming websites about people who make content on YouTube as their primary means of making money and expressing themselves. Like, they're like often that like I've used the term, but derived the term YouTubers because it sounds as though that like from my perch, I'm making them seem like second class citizens in terms of like what they do. When I actually think someone like Donkey does lots of really legitimate, interesting criticism, and lots of other people.
There are lots of fantastic campster does incredible work.
Yes,
like there's a bunch of people.
Joseph Anderson
does really great work. Like Geek Remix is great. There are a huge array of people who are making incredible videos on YouTube and other video platforms, or even people who do it on Twitch who do critical Let's Plays. Like that stuff is out there and exists and is fantastic. And is I think it is detrimental for us to. It's frustrating because when I see an argument like this, there is a part of me that wants to like close ranks. I'd be like, yo, fuck off. Like, yo, fucking catch me outside. Catch these hands. Like, I'm ready to go. Like, for real. Like, it is really frustrating to be like, I've seen people, like, work their asses off to become better writers, to push themselves, to, like, instantiate systems so that they stop using cliched and trite, like, prose. Like, I've seen the work. The work is being done. And that's on top of the notion that the entire argument that he builds starts at a premise that I think is flawed and that we're moving away from, which is that criticism exists to inform purchasing decisions, right? Like, I think there's actually been a move away from that, a move towards argument-driven criticism, even at major sites like Kotaku and Polygon, and away from needing to be comprehensive back-of-box, what-is-this-game list. Like, we've moved away from it. And if you're just learning that shit and you're like, all right, fucking
wake up,
catch up. But then I take a deep breath because part of closing those ranks and like wanting to have those fights. And like, I could go right now.
I believe
but,
you. Flip this table right now,
seriously,
Austin.
Like,
boom.
It gets me heated because I've seen the people put in the work. Like, that's why I get heated on it.
Yeah.
Is I've seen people push themselves to get better at this who traditionally came from outlets that needed to reach an audience that was just trying to say, should I buy this or not? I've seen IGN do it. I've seen IGN transform their reviews. Over the last like 4 years, they've gotten really great reviewers who are able to say something meaningful about a game in not 4,000 word, 4-page reviews. And
well,
so
that IGN and GameSpot are
right.
Like,
monolithic,
like, and I'm not. That's not to denigrate the good work that does happen there,
right.
But like, it shows a shallowness of your understanding of criticisms
right.
Writ large. That there are lots of other critics doing lots of interesting things
yes.
that are not mentioned anywhere in
absolutely.
That video. That's like Dunkey has. I think I saw like 3.6 million
subscribers. Yes.
He is a small fish in a much bigger pond. Like, Dunkey himself is specialized criticism
yes.
within the larger YouTube pond. And so, if, like, he is not an IGN or a GameSpot,
no.
right? Like, PewDiePie is the IGN or GameSpot. If we're, like, thinking, like, the largest, like, most
yes.
trafficked sort of portals for criticism. And so, Dunkey gets away with what he's doing because he's chosen to do something specialized
yes.
and different. And also, he ignores a lot of, like, systemic problems in YouTube
totally.
Video culture in order to make money. So, like, there's an excellent video over – or an article over at Polygon by Slowbeef, who
yes.
is a really thoughtful, interesting YouTube creator who is largely credited, although he doesn't like taking the credit, with coming up with the term Let's Play and
right.
sort of defining that.
But
as
certainly a foundational,
yeah.
important worker inside of the Let's Play field at the
yeah,
very
if you
least.
Do a Google search for it, I interviewed him and sort of tracked the creation of the Let's Play
right.
And wrote about that at Kotaku a couple of years back. And he wrote this editorial for Polygon in which he talks about like the fact that a lot of YouTube creators have to create videos multiple times a day or at least daily in order to keep up
yes.
with the algorithm that is determined by YouTube and how it feeds people information that they can sort of discover through YouTube's algorithm. Like problems like that, which inevitably feed to poor criticism on YouTube because people have to make money and feed themselves. Just problems like that go unacknowledged in a video
right.
that cherry picks problems with the existing sort of model of games criticism and games press and how that makes money and how that sustains people when there are all sorts of problems in YouTube. And I'm not
right.
saying
so,
that
so
that
the,
makes that doesn't
exactly.
make those problems in game criticism go away. I'm just saying don't pretend that there isn't shit going on in your own house.
Well, and that's the thing that ends up being the reason that I don't want to close ranks and be like, let's go like
yeah.
old school media versus new
invite
YouTube
him
culture.
On to this podcast to punch him in the face.
Right,
yes,
I don't want to
exactly.
do that.
Right, right.
Is actually because I think lots of these problems are shared across
yeah.
both of these medium. Like, there are just as many bad trite YouTube criticism
yes.
videos as there are mediocre review, like written reviews in games journalism, right? Like, it's not like there aren't crutches that everybody in this space uses. Like, everybody in this space uses – we've had that conversation. We've talked about the words that I think are dead. We talked about, like, how to get better as a writer.
We
had a
really
visceral conversation about it.
Yeah.
God, I saw visceral used again in just, like, I forget what the word – like, it was exactly one of those terms that – it was exactly the way that makes me bummed
visceral
out to
combat.
See it.
Was it visceral combat?
No, it wasn't visceral combat. Like, that's the thing. It's like, it would have been fine if it was visceral combat. And it was like some other thing that was just completely. Anyway, I'm going to move on. The point is that I actually think that for both YouTube creators and for people who work in traditional journalism, traditional games journalism and coverage, like, there is space to improve and get better at what we do, but it can't come from an argument that, first of all, like, only focuses on consumer-driven criticism as what's happening is actually new niches are being formed in which we can create criticism that isn't consumer-driven and that can sustain itself despite not being about whether or not you want to purchase a product. And secondly, like, what we need to figure out, and what I think, Patrick, one of the things you mentioned to me before was like, this is a moment of growing pains for the entire industry, but especially for people who are working in video,
yeah.
who are trying to figure out, who are going through all the same arguments that we went through a decade ago, and then 5 years ago, and then 3 years ago, over and over again. And part of me like just wants to like sit back and let it happen, and part of me wants to be like, yo, catch up. Like, there's all this stuff that's already happened. Take part in that conversation.
It was so interesting to me to see this come from Dunkey, because I feel like a lot of his best videos don't feel – even if he intends them to be sort of purchasing advice,
right.
they don't feel that way. They feel like an actual like, oh, this is a really interesting take on this game or on this genre or on sort
yeah,
of what's going on here.
He's highly personal about his
exactly.
videos.
Right.
Like,
right.
Exactly.
Well, and is not – the one of the things is like right now, even though he's part of Union for Gamers or whatever, which is the multi-channel network he's part of, that is not a destination the way Kotaku is, the way
sure.
Polygon is, the way GameSpot is. And so he isn't – grouped with those other people. He's allowed to be his own voice.
Yeah.
And what we need is a more industry-wide change that recognizes independent writers and reviewers and video makers who recognizes writers, video makers and reviewers in those big sites as independent voices. We need more, pull quotes that show up in advertisements to not just say, like, GameSpot said this, but to say Peter Brown from GameSpot said this, so that instead of being like who GameSpot believes that Crash Bandicoot is bad, it actually is like, oh no, Peter Brown had this specific reaction to the game, and then you can put that in context. And right now there just is not much of that, which is also just an internet thing,
One thing I like about there's a site I want to give a shout out to. It's called GameCritics.com. Yep. They often do second and even third and occasionally even fourth responses to games. They do multiple reviews. Obviously, that is not something that everybody can do. I understand the bandwidth, but there are options for this. Mm-hmm. There are ways of doing a sidebar or something else, or somebody else found this interesting, or you can revisit something.
I mean, there are, and also, I mean, the thing that's so tough is there are, and also the metrics don't always support that. Like,
they probably pretty much never support that.
They pretty much never support that.
Yeah.
Or you see, what I see a lot of is people finding the space to do it. Someone like JV Gwaltney over at Game Informer has a weekly column where he's able to dive back into stuff that he's already done. Pat and Nick over at Polygon just did a video about Wolfenstein. And, like, that's like loosely pegged on Wolfenstein getting a sequel.
Sure.
You find those opportunities to do it.
Yeah, you make that case, and then you go for
and
it.
And to
kind of
me,
thing. Yeah.
That issue, the issue of, like, doing niche coverage of stuff that is not new product releases, that is not tied to a big news event, which is a problem that every outlet has to deal with in terms of trying to get coverage or get their coverage seen, is not, as Patrick said, is not unique to
exactly.
The written word, is not unique to major outlets. That is also a YouTube problem. And that this could be a super productive conversation about how you address that, how you build communities, how you build ways of monetizing this stuff that does allow you to create interesting criticism that is not only tied to new releases, that is not only tied to, like, a product-driven system. And, like, maybe 9 minutes just didn't give that dude enough time to dig into what what do we do. But, like, I don't know. Like, there are pieces going around today on global warming. And a lot of the response to that, it's, like, a very doom and gloom piece. It's a very, like, yo, we fucked. Like, there is not a space for us to
we
eke
should
out.
Build bunkers.
Right, exactly.
Like, we really
right.
should.
And a lot of the response I've seen to that is, like this is – the doom and gloom here is useful insofar as it gets us talking about this issue in that, like, maybe we would have missed this article otherwise. But we need productive solutions. We need suggestions on directions that we can investigate. And that's what I want from any conversation that's about the state of games journalism, games criticism. It's like, oh, well, what do we actually do better? Because the answer is, like, there's no answer here. Like, the right. outside of
– Well, the answer in the video is do it like I do.
Right, but that's not ever going to happen
right.
for a GameSpot.
Like, if everyone could just start a YouTube channel and have 3.6 million subscribers, like, man, it should be a lot easier.
It would be way easier.
I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be at Waypoint.
Of course,
I'd be on YouTube.
We would all be on YouTube. Exactly. And, like – And also, but also, I'm not convinced that the market can sustain 300 game critics who have 3.6 million views
right.
or subscribers. Do you know what I mean? Or whatever that number is. Like, if
well,
every.
That's, and that's why you see, look at what Danny O'Dwyer, Drew Scanlon,
yeah,
lots
totally.
Of folks are doing where they, you know, they have an idea, they raise money on something like Patreon,
right.
And they go and make those videos. Neither of those channels has millions of subscribers. Like, because, like, people believed in an idea, fund it. And then it doesn't the
right.
traffic that
direct to consumer
matter.
Stuff.
That's just
yeah.
a different model of
totally.
Of how you build around that. And that works for some people. That works for people with established personalities,
right.
established audiences.
Say.
That that doesn't work for if Rando number one said, I want to travel the world and make videos on it on YouTube, like, you're not gonna do that. You do that because you trust Drew Scanlon to go do that. Doesn't mean the other person wouldn't be just as good. You just don't have an established relationship with that person.
Right.
The thing is, I guess part of what I found frustrating about it was because I do like a lot of Dunkey's work and find him
right.
to be, like, very thoughtful
yeah.
about – like, I've also been thankful because my wife likes to watch his videos. Like, she thinks he's funny, and he has a way of showing what's interesting about games through humor that if I was to show her a video that was, like, a super thoughtful, like, well-edited, like – explaining why a game is interesting, like, her eyes are gonna glaze over. And so he still manages to show why a game is interesting and do it in a thoughtful way, but make you laugh along that journey. And it ends up, like, making her watch videos for games that, like, she wouldn't, there's no way I could get her, like, to watch
right.
a 9-minute video about this. But he finds a way to make that interesting. And so I guess I just felt a little bummed. This is the work you put in for this video? This is it? Yeah. I expect more from the work he does in other videos that he's done, because I've seen him put in more work to those videos. And so this just shows like a very shallow, not particularly thoughtful interpretation of a bunch of problems that, yo, if we could have solved that 15 years ago, we would have.
Yeah, if we could get rid of review scores from major sites. I don't know, Rob, you've been in this industry for a long fucking time and like have seen it from staff writing positions, from editorial positions, from freelance positions, from like behind the scenes managerial positions. Like how do we address this, or like do we address the number problem? Do we try to address as a games review culture any of the things that he's put forward, or do you think this is just like a thing that we'll keep returning to every decade forever?
Yeah, I think we're doomed to keep repeating this conversation until global warming takes us all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, you're all part of the Anthropocene.
I think some of it is coming from a place where what I see in that video is sort of a cry for the sort of personal relationship with games critics that someone can have with Dunkey, that Dunkey apparently feels with other YouTube critics, and I suspect probably used to feel with some outlets before things got a little bit diluted.
Right. Well, what do you mean by diluted there? Or what do you think he means by diluted there? Or, you know, I don't want to put his words in your mouth necessarily.
I think it used to be easier. Okay, there's two things. I'm in danger of conflating them.
Mm-hmm.
There's the idea that an outlet has a really strong overall voice and identity. That, like, no matter whose byline it is, or maybe there's not even a byline, depending on the outlet, but no matter who's there, the outlet has a voice and an approach that you somehow feel connected to and that you can entrust yourself to. And that has become harder to feel, I think. And that's for a couple of reasons. I think, one, we're a lot more media savvy and a lot more maybe media cynical than we were 10, 15 years ago. I think, you know, I definitely put on rose-tinted lenses when I think about the old Ziff Davis 1UP and, you know, CGW days. I was blind to a lot of the maybe compromises and pressures those groups felt until they were sort of explicitly talking about them. But I remember in the 90s, I sort of did feel this sort of collective identification with an outlet like Computer Gaming World, with an outlet like PC Gamer. Now that has gotten, I think, maybe a little broken down, in part because reviews and games criticism has become, I think, commodified in a way that it didn't used to be.
In what way?
More interchangeable. It's being treated more interchangeably than it used to be. I mean,
what do you think is like the cause of that? Or give me, can you give me an example of that in some way? Like, in what way was a review of, you know, you go back 20 years or something, you think about like a Half-Life review, the review of Half-Life in CGW when it first ran. I don't know who wrote that review, versus like a review of Prey this year that would run on an IGN or a GameSpot. Like, how do you mean commodified in that sense?
20 years ago, like, I can literally tell you this because, like, I'm good friends with a lot of people who were freelancing back in the day. Like, two people I work, you know, pretty regularly with and closely with, over on Three Moves Ahead, you got Troy Goodfellow, Bruce Garrick, and Tom Chick, when we can get him. And 20 years ago, they would have been paid $1,500, maybe more, for one of those big marquee reviews, and they would have been, then that would have been the project for the month. By the way, like, that would have been their critical work that they were devoting themselves to.
They play this 20-hour game, and then they put in another 20 hours of work on writing it, reviewing it, taking edits, taking notes, rewriting, sending off, getting screenshots ready, whatever.
And there would have been editorial patience for that as well.
Yes, by the way,
like it would, like you'd have been hitting a print deadline, obviously, but there would have been time to go through a pretty involved process about this. I'm in the same line of work. I came to it, you know, 20 years later.
Right.
And that same piece of work would have been a few hundred dollars if it was a good outlet paying good rates.
Yep.
There were definitely a lot of places I worked where it would have been like, look, we can give you like $50.
Yep.
Yep.
But you'll get your name out there, and there were times that deal was worth it. But it does mean that to make any kind of living doing that, you've got to become much more machine-like, much, much faster. And you do not get the space or sort of the love and attention from editors to sort of, like, create that kind of work. But maybe more importantly, also give it sort of an individual voice. That it's not just a review that's got to hit a deadline and go out the door.
Right.
And, you know, it'll get hits or not. 20 years ago, this is the CGW review of this game. This is our big review from a name you have a relationship with that we're, you know, that we are invested in. And I think that made it easy to feel that connection with an outlet.
So you were able to say this CGW review, even though it's a subjective opinion of the writer, carry certain traits or priorities that would not be found on another outlet. But I guess like that's where this is where it gets tricky for me is like,
yeah.
I think as a writer, I guess maybe that's not true. So like, I definitely think, you know, I've written for a number of sites, and when I wrote for GameSpot, for instance, there were definitely like asides that I would have to cut because they don't quite fit in, or like I'd have to have that conversation with my editor and say like, no, listen, like, I know I'm just writing about Project Cars, a game about driving, but I, you know, a game about racing, but I wanted to dedicate this whole paragraph to the notion of driving. Yeah. Let me explore this. It's important context. And I have to have that conversation in a way that, like, if I was writing for Paste, Garrett Martin, who's the editor, not the editor-in-chief, the editor of the gaming section at Paste, would be like, give me the leeway to do that, because it's more in the Paste voice to allow me to do that. Is that kind of what you mean when you talk about there being a unified, and what, I guess what we think Dunkey means when we talk about having a unified or a cohesive, like, outlet voice?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think you've got a set of hands that are consistently trying to consistently shaping things to sort of reflect the outlet's identity and values.
Right.
And that may still happen, but I do feel like a lot of the review, the places he's specifically talking about, it no longer feels like there's, in a lot of those places, I'm not sure it always feels like there's as much leeway to individualize and personalize things that you maybe got in computer gaming world 20 years ago.
A lot
of that stuff has ended up, I think, in outlets like Paste, which are a little more, maybe niche is the way to put it. Like, I've always assumed that Paste's rates are maybe not the highest.
Paste works with a lot of young freelancers who are, like, for their first time. Like, Garrett is also someone who will give someone a chance who does not have any, like, writing publication, and the rates reflect that, I think. Like,
that's not a knock, but it does mean that, like, a lot of places that allow the most, like, character and individuality in their pieces also tend to be maybe the most, like, you know, like, almost like renegade. It's the unwinnables. It's the Paste. It's the sort of the smaller personal outlets that you don't find that same approach necessarily at an IGN.
So I guess the thing there, though, is that's tough is there's this double bind, which is on one hand, what Dunkey wants, what I think a lot of people want, including me, is more voice-driven, subjective criticism that recognizes that opinions are subjective, that writers have peculiarities, that they have personal expertise, they have tastes, they have interests that are not just, is this thing a thing worth buying?
Right.
At the same time, what Dunkey says he wants, and it sounds like what you want to some degree, Rob, is a return to the notion that, like, this outlet is producing the outlet's response to this game. This is Waypoint, not Waypoint, because we don't do traditional, but putting a stamp on it, right? This is GameSpot's take on Sonic. And he goes so far as to say it's incongruous when an outlet says there are no good – someone at an outlet says there is no good Sonic games, but also they've published an 8 or 9, you know, 0.0 review score of a Sonic game in the last year. And, like, I'm just never going to be there for that argument. I'm just never going to be there for, like, well, our reviewer liked it, and so I don't think that that's incongruous at all. I think that there's no incongruity there. Like, to me, that is just – this is what the editor has decided, has pushed back on the writer when they've given their review. The writer says, like, no, I really think this is an 8.5. Sonic is back, baby. Like, finally, we return to the glory days. And also that
there
editor
were no
can –
glory days.
And also the editor can later say – there are no glory days. My writer thinks there was. I edited that rigorously. I pushed back. They gave me their argument. Their argument stood up. But, like, there, I would never
but
want
they're
there
wrong.
To.
Yeah.
Right, but
like,
they're
to
wrong.
Say that,
I would
right.
never want there
right.
to be a site that's like, no, this is a.
Our writer's
this is
an
not
idiot,
a pro
you know? Like,
Sonic. you know, outlet.
Yeah.
We're never going to give a Sonic game a 9.5 or whatever, you know?
But I think so this is actually the sort of the problem I had with that entire video. I actually liked the video quite a bit, but there's also games being played in that video that mm-hmm. actually make it really difficult to figure out what parts of this video are, like, meant to be intellectually honest and which are just him taking the piss. Because mm-hmm. the entire video is him kind of demonstrating the critical values he wants to see in the world, but then also sort of, like, showcasing his own hypocrisy when it comes to those stated values. And so there's kind of the shell game being played
yeah.
throughout that video of, like, oh, these are the things I believe, except for these when I don't.
Right.
Like, it's,
except
it's
fuck this- Sonic, et cetera. Right.
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, what does he actually want? I'm not sure. When I'm talking about sort of this imagined golden era of games criticism and outlets, was that ever real? Like, it's how it felt.
Right.
I'm talking about, like,
but we
the
just
subjective
weren't
experience.
Savvy. You right. know what I mean? Like, that's the
if
thing.
We were
like,
13.
That's the actual yeah. double bind is we want more subjective criticism, but also in understanding that criticism is subjective, it eviscerates the notion of ever seeing again an outlet that has a unified voice. Like, I'm always going to be able to see the seams going forward.
Right.
I think, and at the same time, as the editor-in-chief of Waypoint, want Waypoint to have a central voice. I know when I look at a piece, when we get a pitch in, I can go like, that isn't a good fit. And what do I mean by that is it doesn't fit something that we want to achieve with Waypoint. Like, and that can be a hard soft. It's a hard slash soft. It's a difficult thing.
It's a hard soft.
It's a hard
there's
soft.
Not, like, there's, I get not, it. There's not like lines in the sand.
Right.
It's more like it's like something in your gut. It's a tone.
There
it's
are
like,
some lines in the sand.
It's how you know you're
okay,
in love.
I know, but you're not like we don't have like a document that says like
no.
this is Waypoint. This isn't Waypoint.
No.
It's something that like,
it would be easier if we had a document.
It's true. If we had an algorithm.
I mean, because that's part of what, you know, appeal all, like, you know, his argument of it's easier when it's one person, one voice. Like, I like working with a collective. Like, I like working with a group. Not that I don't enjoy doing my own solo stuff, but, like, Waypoint is stronger, like, with a bunch of voices that have sort of a collective sort of feel, opinions. Like, we are not all one and the same, and yet, like, we are mm-hmm. on roughly a certain page that allows us to project a certain tone and voice for the website, and it is a stronger voice by having several people who are contributing to it as opposed to one singular. Like, I think there are different ways to approach it, but I don't think it, like, just because one voice can be powerful on its own mm-hmm. does not reduce the idea of, like, multiple voices contributing to a single idea or ideals is also equally powerful in its own right.
There's something else that bugs me here, too. It always did. Donkey Hole, like, creates this juxtaposition of, like, when a Total Biscuit review comes in, you know it's Total Biscuit. When it's my review, you know it's me. These freelance writers you're citing aren't
yeah.
fucking hiding, man.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
if
their
you want to know your
right
critic,
there. Yeah.
It's real easy
all
to do that.
All of them have a Twitter account.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, when I was, like, freelancing, it always bugged me a little bit, and it happened more at some of the big sites than not, where you'd find somebody playing that fucking game of, like, this is ridiculous, because IGN gave this game this, and now Zach, like, now this reviewer is for IGN is giving a similar game a completely different score. This is internally inconsistent. And it's like, look, Rowan Kaiser and I disagree on a million things.
Yeah.
Sometimes that guy sucks. No, love you, Rowan. But the point
Rowan.
Is, though, you
love
can
you.
Go online and you see our, like, you can see our body of work.
Yeah.
You can sort of see the things we're bringing to each, like, piece
like
we're
the,
reviewing.
Well, like, the most frustrating thing is he pulls up an example of how GameSpot literally does this in the text of the pages. When you write a review for GameSpot, or I think Polygon does this too, maybe it was Kotaku, it's like at the bottom, I think it's Polygon, at the bottom you're like, my name, like, you know, so-and-so,
this is whoever. Yeah.
Janine Hawkins loves farming games. She's most recently played blah, 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 and she first started playing them during Harvest Moon. Like, Rob Zachney is a big fan of 4X games. He'll never get back the hours he lost playing as the Spaniards in Civ 3 or whatever. Like, you write up a new one of those at the bottom as the footer of every review so that you can give your reader at least some loose context of what you like and who you are. And, like, he uses one of those to dunk on Peter Brown because in it he says up front, like,
hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot.
we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I put Peter Brown played through half of the new Crash games, the remasters of those Crash games, which is just like, I can't believe it is 2017 and we're still fucking arguing.
If you have to beat the game to have an opinion
about it. I can't believe it. And it's growing pains. It's growing pains.
A remaster, by the way.
Yeah, you have to beat the remaster. Fuck. Just say what you played and like talk, as long as you're upfront about it. Like, it's chill.
Just talk. Just be honest. There's a part of this that I understand the frustration of average reader going to a place being like, look, I've got $60
100%.
For the next 6 months.
This is why I'll defend review scores if I have to.
I need to find the thing that will give me the most bang for my buck after work, that kind of thing. I respect that is a place where a lot of people are coming from. Every time I talk to people who don't do anything like this and I tell them what I do, of course, the first thing is always, wow, what a cool job. And I'm like, I know, I'm pretty lucky. I hit the jackpot in the job market. And then the second thing is always like, oh, but what's actually good? What's good?
Right.
They don't necessarily...
What's hot right now?
Exactly. They don't necessarily want to know all of the stuff that we are interested in, because this is our profession. This is our job. We want to dive into things. I think we should dive into things. I think there's a great place for that. I do respect that there is a desire for something that looks like a... opinion with a stamp on it. I respect that. I do wish that sort of years of product product journalism didn't sort of ruin people to want that opinion, I suppose.
Right.
Not ruin people. That's a really judgy way of saying that. Sorry.
But
ruin people's expectations or prime you to expect a very specific thing. And now that we're moving away from that, or at least attempting to move away from that, it feels like but that's what people really want.
This is part of the thing was like in the video, Dunkey suggests that the reason that every game gets between a 7 and a 10, that there's not every game, but that there is the reason that there's a weight towards the 7 and 10 is because of publisher relationship. I think Phil Kohler from Polygon was like, actually the most response I get if I give a low score is from fans, not from publisher.
Sure.
Like if I'm scared at all, it's not because like Ubisoft is going to call me up and be like, no, that game was good.
Poison Him at E3.
It's because like, oh, I guess I don't get to use Twitter this week. Like, I guess this is just going to be like a billion people who love Ezio are going to be like in my mentions, be like, no, Ezio's good.
But even there, like, even again, it's another example of this video being kind of internally inconsistent, because earlier in the video, he also says a lot of like the staff critics you find at these outlets like only play major games and they don't play everything that's out there. And voila, we found the 7 to 10 bias in the reviews. Congratulations.
Right.
As somebody who like used to review a whole bunch of shit that editors couldn't be bothered to review, let me tell you.
That's where those fives are. What,
there's some twos out
there. I know
what
the 5 looks like.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's tough. I also think that we're not going to go into like what the 10-point score system emboldens in terms of scoring, but it is like such an old thing. Someone in the chat, I think Ewok's Kick, was like, wait, so do y'all not think that you need to complete the game to give it a score? I think that we're all adults, and if in the review you say, I didn't complete this game, and here's what I'm scoring it based on what I gave it, or based on what I played through, here's my 25 hours. I think that that as a reader, you should feel comfortable being like, oh, you didn't play it all the way through. That matters to me. I'll go find a different review. Once you've said out loud, here is what I've played of this game, you should feel comfortable.
I think it's like a general expectation that you finish a game,
but of course
if you disclose, you're good.
Yep.
You
cover
said
your
it.
Ass.
You
and
said it.
Yeah, and that, it can be something that you take issue with, and then that's fine. Like, that, the glory of YouTube and Twitter and everything is
you will find someone else.
Different,
there will be somebody
you can find
there.
Someone who beat that game. I mean, that ignores, you know, sometimes what people bring up, I think rightly so, is like the larger realities of things like Metacritic, that some outlets dump into Metacritic, some don't, and like how that feeds into how publishers like dish out royalties. And so the idea that someone would play 20 hours a game but not 40 hours a game, and what if they liked it at the end of 40 hours a game, that influences the royalties for a developer whose games maybe you like. I mean, like, I see how that chain goes, and I understand the problems there. You know, fortunately, we don't have to deal with Metacritic. We have no interest in being on Metacritic. But, you know, I get why that is
It's complicated. And I think that there, again, like, I don't know, we've said this from the jump that, like, just because we don't have review scores doesn't mean that we don't value what reviews and why people want review scores. Yeah. And, like, all of this stuff is a bunch of small micro populations who have different perspectives on what they need from games scores. The sorts of people who are having the conversation we're having are such a small, like, that video has 3 million views. That's, or like 2.3 million views, which is, like, not nothing, but it's a tiny smidgen of what.
Who plays games.
Yeah. And including who plays big budget games, who plays console games, who plays indie games on Steam. Like, all of those smaller conversations are happening that have different interests. Some of them want there to be curators on Steam. Some of them would hate if you're a curator on Steam. Some of them want every game to be on multi-platform. Some of them only want them to come to Xbox. Some of them are really in love with backwards compatibility. I had a guy message me the other day on Twitter who runs a retail store. He's like, I don't get why my customers care about backwards compatibility. Don't they, like, just bring out the old fucking system? And, like, all of those different voices are so keyed into different parts of this conversation that when these larger conversations bubble up, like, I think some of the discourse around it reflects the fact that there are just all of these different kind of, like, demographic positions on the huge web of people who care about games. And I don't know, I just try to keep that context in mind when I think it through all this stuff. Like, none of this is going to change tomorrow. But I do think that the fact that this conversation bubbles up again and again suggests or reflects larger systemic changes in what's happening, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think we got it out of our system.
We got our stamp on it. That was the Waypoint stamp.
Seal of approval.
This is it.
We did it. That's the Waypoint conversation. But even that's not true, right? Because, right. And this is the thing that's tough about this, is, like, Mike Diver wasn't on this conversation. Right. And Mike is a key part of the team. Danik is not part of this conversation. Danik is a key part of the team.
Yes.
Our freelancers are not part of this conversation. And if you think that there's a Waypoint without a Cameron Kunzelman, a Janine Hawkins, a
Jordan
Lewis
Mallory.
Gordon, a Jordan Mallory, yeah. You know, like a Kate Gray, like, there are so many people who have contributed, and Ed Smith, like, these are people whose voices have appeared on the site over and over and over again. And I would always prefer to be, you know, this is like, if I'm going to err in one direction, I'm going to err in being descriptive instead of prescriptive, which means, like, I want to know what the waypoint is that exists for real and want to address that instead of being like, no, what waypoint is blank and anything that doesn't fit into that isn't really waypoint. And I think that's basically the way I think about all outlets is like, all right, what's Polygon actually like today? Like, what is Polygon? What does it mean? Not what do they achieve? Do they aspire to be? Not what are their ambitions? Not what are their stated intentions? What is Polygon actually? What is GameSpot actually? And in almost every case, what I see is a group of people who are working their asses off to produce games criticism, games news coverage, to share entertaining videos. Like, all of that stuff is what I see. And it doesn't mean that I like it all, but, like, I fundamentally push back on the notion that there is a unique sickness inside of games journalism. And in fact, think that there are lots of people trying their best to work hard the same way as there are on YouTube. I don't know. That's the Austin Walker take.
Like,
I'll stand by
there
the Austin Walker fucking
that.
Take.
Yeah.
I don't think that I'm not speaking for everybody else here. Deep breath. Okay, shake it out. That's everybody.
Yeah,
do a
roll
little
those
stretch.
Shoulders. You know, roll them up, roll them back.
Patrick, how's your daughter doing? You doing your how's
she woke up for a little bit.
Okay.
And then she fell asleep again.
Rob, why are you?
Subterfuge is happening.
Rob, how are your
see,
submarines?
See, she woke up. She woke up for a few minutes.
She woke up and launched a sneak
That's
attack
what she did.
On Rob.
Then she went back to sleep. She's fake sleeping.
She has a phone.
She, see?
Well, it's normally she has my phone, so that's usually.
Okay. Nora, do you give her games to play? And are there any of them about sneak submarine attacks?
Can you do that while playing the Moana soundtrack on Spotify? Is that like a secret?
Things with babies.
Moana takes place in the ocean, right? Like near an ocean.
See?
True.
So, I don't know. Subterfuge. Rob, can we talk about subterfuge?
Can you explain what this
is?
Oh,
we can talk about subterfuge.
Do you want to set up what subterfuge is?
Is sort of a – if you're familiar with the board game Diplomacy, it's sort of like Diplomacy for your phone. It's a strategy game where the way combat and like the actual conflict is resolved is very, very straightforward and very simple. And that moves the focus to player-to-player interactions and bargaining and alliances. The key thing about subterfuge is that unlike in a lot of strategy games – nothing's actually, like, codified. Like, it's not like in Civilization where you can say, like, we're allies now.
Right.
And therefore you can't immediately turn around and stab them in the back. I think you used to be able to do that in Civ, but they kind of took that away. So now you have to, like, sort of take your relationship up and down in notches. in subterfuge, you can just screw anybody at any time.
So you're basically, and, like, the very broad picture is you're a submarine commander. You're a submarine commander. You have underwater stations, and you want to expand out your borders and increase your drilling for some mineral, right? And the way you win the game is either by being the last person standing or to hit a certain count of the mineral or to have a certain amount of stations, if I'm remembering correct. And there is a tactical side of this game where you win encounters by having more attack subs than the opponent has defense subs plus their home base or whatever their attack strength is.
But then there's also specialist characters so you could change the math a bit.
Send a bomb that could destroy a base, or you could have a special spy who could – whatever. There's all sorts of like
specialist
characters.
There's a critical detail.
Okay.
The game is continuous time.
Right.
Oh,
it is always – it is always running.
Yes.
And so somebody can do something at 3 a.m, or you can have the experience. Okay, so this was me last night. Like, I am exhausted. Like, I have been, like, I reorganized a lot of the house, you know, doing some moving stuff. I was tired. I was about to go to bed. I was literally, like, slipping under the covers, putting the phone on the charger, and I noticed the notification light is blinking, and I open it up, and there's a ton of, like, status messages. Like,
oh, no.
Okay, like, there's 5 new fleets that have appeared on your sonar. There's 4 new diplomatic messages from other players. And everybody is online all at once, which usually means some shit is about to go down. Like, you see these little pips of color corresponding to each player. Everyone is online and watching this game. And what was happening last night, and I can talk about this now, because I think it's already basically happened, is
Shit. You're like Ozymandias up in here. God. You're like, you think I got to tell you this plan if it already happened 20 minutes ago?
So I had a really perilous border with 2 other players, and it looked like they were going to come after me, and if they did, I was going to be in real deep trouble. So I was doing this like frantic last-minute diplomacy, trying to like change the numbers and change the math. And I was like drawing other players into the conversation. And some of us have played before, and some of these people have played together a lot. And so like there's each individual game is not quite individualized. There's history between the players that you
can
play on.
There have been betrayals. There have been allegiances that have stood the test of time.
Yeah. And so like in the middle of the night last night, like midnight, I'm like, I can't go to bed yet. Like, I need to see how this is going to shake out. And so from, like, midnight to 1, I'm frantically messaging, like, 4 other people trying to, like, change the diplomatic structure of this game and, like, get intelligence updates from everyone else. Like, where'd that fleet go? Have you seen what happened to that one fleet that was moving a little while earlier? And it finally, it broke in my favor. Nick Capizzoli had sort of fitted me up, and he was going to team up with another player to wipe me out. And that other player was basically like, yeah, Nick thinks I'm going to do that.
Oh, shit.
But I'm not.
Oh, word. Did they do the thing? So one of my favorite things, I played a game with Jack DeKeet and another Twitter friend of mine years ago. Jack DeKeet, also a Waypoint friend.
Also, I was going to say another key voice.
And what we ended up doing, this really key moment, was that Jack agreed with a third party to send attack ships to capture my thing. And at the last possible minute, he turned them from attack ships into gift ships. He gifted me a bunch of submarines instead of attacking with them. And that, like, completely saved my ass.
You didn't look a gift ship in the mouth.
It's not even a pun, Danielle. You just changed the words.
I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Giggle, Jesus Christ.
And so, yeah, that was a big. I love that you can do that sort of stuff. It's like, oh yeah, this is actually good.
The gift ship thing is a real, like that scene in Braveheart where the two armies run at each other and then they like bro out in the middle of the field and turn against Longshanks.
Yeah,
like that is a classic subterfuge move that I've seen happen in a few places where it instantly changes the entire dynamic of the game. Yeah, so it's a really, like, playing a game subterfuge always feels like a mistake.
Yep.
Because you start out and you're like, this is fun. Man, I missed this shit. And then you're 3 or 4 days in and that itch has been scratched.
Yeah.
Like, you've had your fill of subterfuge, but now you're kind of invested. And so you're doing things like setting your alarm for 2:30 in the morning to launch a fleet. You know, Capo, like, posted a screenshot on Twitter the other day of him setting notifications on his phone, muting all notifications while he sleeps, except for subterfuge notifications, which he wanted to wake him up. That's what you turned into.
So I actually wrote about this game for Paste years ago. I think in like 2013, 2015.
Oh,
God,
you
not
know,
that,
that
not that many
like
years,
years
ago. It sure does. The thing that was wild for me was when I was playing it. You can look that piece up. Just search for Paste Subterfuge Austin. I think you'll find it. I was playing it while I was also in the middle of the last, or not the last, but a previous big video game discourse monster. Like we were all, it was the formalism versus whatever debate at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And that was extra wild because on one side of that debate, on the opposite side of me was like Frank Lance in the NYU Game Center at the time, while I was interviewing for a job at the NYU Game Center, which is like, and also meanwhile, I was already up at night in the middle of the night playing like Subterfuge at 5 a.m. So I was just like this intense ball of panic for a week straight.
Oh, my God.
I ended up losing that game too. It was very close, but like,
oh, my God.
It was very intense.
People are messaging me. They're watching this. Like people,
I know. I see people
this.
In the chat.
I'm
Robot Parking, who's a Canadian games academic, who I knew back, who's also in that larger debate. It's like, now you're trapped. Trapped is the word you're looking for, Rob. You're trapped in Subterfuge. Earlier, he also said in the chat, Rob, stop talking and start fucking Nick up. Which is like, yes. If we had infinite time, if we could like dedicate a week to playing Subterfuge, if we could get a sponsor, if we could get someone
documentary.
To
documentary,
like, yeah, a documentary of us playing this game together, I would do it because it would be incredible fun. But also,
the waypoint 72 days of betrayal.
Yes, exactly. The new 72. It would be really good because we'd all hate each other by the end. But also, it just takes so much time and energy to play that game. I just can't fit it into my life ever again.
I'm too nice to play that game.
You start out that way. And by the end, the knives are going to come out.
Someone
very close to you would betray you, and that would be it.
Oh, I guess that's true.
It's interesting that there are some people who like have a code. There are Omars of
right.
Of Subterfuge, and then there's people who like,
you know,
are gleeful in their shittiness. Like literally, like they see what's possible in this game, and they're like, "Oh yeah, this is for me. I want to be like, imagine Littlefinger or Carcetti, but with like a tenth the integrity." And they're like, "Hell yeah, that's who I'm gonna be."
That's Subterfuge.
Nick actually wrote for me, just not here when I was at Giant Pop. Subterfuge has carried me for the last few years.
Yeah.
He wrote a column over at Giant Bomb last April called "The Known Unknowns of Subterfuge," which is not a very clickable headline. I'm looking at it. This is not good packaging. In which he actually compares Subterfuge to not compares it, but draws a line between it and the Robert McNamara documentary by Errol Morris. What is the name of that? The Fog of War.
Yes.
And like talks about, kind of about that game and like the notion of international conflict and politics and war. And it's a very good piece. People should go read that also.
Wow.
We should go read all these pieces on different websites. welcome to Austin Walker promoting shit that isn't on Waypoint.
That's fine.
Let us know. I'm really curious come Friday how haggard you will look. When will this game be over, probably, Rob?
Oh, God.
No one knows. You're really trapped. You really,
like,
really
somebody,
are.
Like somebody mentioned the other day, as all hell broke loose, somebody was like, "I cannot believe this is only day two because it like this is not even we've not even played three full days of this game.
You're fucked."
And I feel like I've been playing this game for
you're
years.
Done.
How many days does a game usually go?
The first one
I think the last game we played spanned two, possibly three presidential debates between Clinton and Trump.
No,
The
Jesus
last
Christ.
No.
That's way longer than the ones
that's
that
I've... That's like 4 years.
My first one took 8.5 days. So that's a small number. I guess people have gotten good at this game to where they can just kind of stalemate for a long time.
Yeah, I might be misremembering that. I do remember, though, we had sort of a Christmas truce for the last debate.
Oh.
Where, like, we were all at each other's throats, but the debate came on. And it became this like weird group therapy session in the Subterfuge group chat where we were all trying to murder each other, but like everyone is just sort of reacting to this and is like, "Is this for real?" It was great. It was totally like everyone coming out of their trenches to watch this like fucked up political disintegration, and then we all go back to our trenches and resume the murder.
You sang songs, you shared a nip,
maybe two,
maybe ten, you know.
the fact that you can't quite remember how long the games go is, I think, an answer in and of itself. Just becomes a fugue state by the end. And then two, also, I kind of love the notion of tying Subterfuge around not political, world events. Just like, all right, this is going to be one of those weeks. I'm going to play a game of Subterfuge, so I'll always remember where I have this, like, one little outlet around this terrible event. I kind of want, like, the PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds version of Subterfuge. Mm-hmm. Just give it to me in a day. Just give me a one-day version of this that's, like, the slightly more condensed.
It keeps kind of, condensing on itself.
Exactly. We've got to push in. We're contesting
somebody
smaller
has to go
space.
Every hour.
Yeah,
something like that.
Great.
Or, maybe it, like, starts at – somebody has to go every 4 hours.
Yeah.
And then it kind of comes down to, like –
that would be so good. Developers, think about that.
Game design.
Yeah, that game's good. Check it out. It's on iOS and Android, I think. Anybody else playing anything this week? I know we're going a little long.
I played Hollow Knight. I can talk about it next time, though. That'd be fun.
Just tell me a little bit about Hollow Knight. Hollow Knight was a game that I wanted to play forever ago, and I never got around to it.
Yeah, it came out the end of February, which was like Horizon Zero Dawn pre-Zelda. Remember pre-Zelda?
That
was
vaguely
2.5 years ago.
Yeah.
So, end of February, and I hadn't picked it up until recently because, as with many good things in my life, my girlfriend started playing it, got really hooked, and now we're playing it together. We're sort of hot-seating it, which is lovely and amazing. It's a 2D sort of both Metroidvania-ish, and it does take some DNA from Dark Souls. I'm not going to call it a Souls-like. It does have some Souls-like elements to it.
Okay.
What does that mean?
It means if you die, you lose all your money, and you have to go sort of kill your a ghost of your previous self to get your money back. It's very Souls-ish.
Is the money your XP also? Or are you leveling up that way?
Yeah, because you're buying upgrades, basically.
Okay.
So that's the element that's like
It's a 2D action platformer,
It's a 2D
right?
action platformer. Okay. Yeah, you have a little sword.
Really
little
beautiful.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Hand-animated visuals.
Yeah, it's absolutely
beautiful. You know what I mean. Lots of things are hand-animated, but
it has that sense of like an old cartoon, like a very old, very beautifully, very sort of lushly animated cartoon. It has almost, not quite monochromatic, but semi-monochromatic. It's very, like, dark, very, sort of black and white with a little blue and a little red and a little purple, that kind of thing. So it's gorgeous. And it's just a really, really well-designed – the map itself in this game is maybe the element I'm most excited about. There is a massive amount of exploration.
Okay.
There is,
you're a big fan of that.
Oh, yeah. You know,
I can see you glowing as you talk about
it. I'm glowing from the Hollow Knight. And it's funny because I actually am jumping into this sort of halfway through the game.
Yeah.
So I sort of had to learn quickly in the middle of the – it's fungi. Forest or something. That sounds like a Donkey Kong Country level, which I know.
But yeah,
it's something
bit.
Fungi caverns somewhere. It's all right. Halfway through the game-ish. Combat feels really, really good for like a 2D sort of action platformer. There's all kinds of different enemy types. They all require a different approach. You can sort of bounce on certain things. You have to hit things from the side. Certain things explode, that sort of thing. So there's a lot of variety already going on in any given room, which is really, really good. And yeah, just a lot of good exploration. And I suppose another Souls-like element is that the levels are massive and giant and you can't go everywhere at first.
Okay.
But you open up shortcuts that let you go through sections of the level so you can go back and save if you're sort of at that point. And a lot of boss fights, a lot of
I've heard that the boss fights specifically sometimes feel a little unfair in terms of timing and
it's
stuff.
It's a little hard.
Or I guess the thing I specifically heard was that enemy attacks come very quickly.
Yes.
So it's you're on the defensive kind of a lot.
Quite often. Yeah, you have to be very, very quick. You're like a little bunny. So there's a lot of you got to hop. You have to think about where you're hopping really quickly. There's a dash midair that you have to sort of use really, really intelligently or else you'll be toast really quickly.
This makes me want to go check in on Dead Cells again.
Me too.
Oh, Dead Cells.
Dead Cells is super good.
I
want to play more of both of those things. Dixonvid actually just asked me if I'd play more Final Fantasy XII. I've not had more time to do that. But the reviews came out for that today.
Oh.
The remaster, and they seemed pretty positive. So I'm going to maybe try to push. And I had someone write in but message me on Twitter and basically say, like, hey, keep at it. Like, you will hit a level of complexity that you'll be happy with soon. So I'm
going
to try to put some more time into it. I really want to write about it, but I've not found the time. This is the dilemma.
It's not enough of that.
It's not enough time. Let's take a quick dip into the question bucket and get, one quick question, and then we'll wrap up. How's that sound?
Yeah.
Anybody else playing anything while I'm looking through questions?
No chicken dinner.
Aww.
Fuck. We had not a bad run today. We just didn't get a good.
How did the rest of your run go?
I found a. Were you not there? You were left, right? I died very short.
For people that aren't aware, as soon as we started streaming this morning, I had a call from my kid's daycare that was like, hey, come pick up your kid. And I was like, all right. I'll do one run and then I'll go. I mean, my kid was not dying, so
please subterfuge thing again.
Harshly.
This was all part of it.
It was all part of the subterfuge.
I remember sitting back down after taking the call and then being like, where are we in the map? Like, I don't, that's an interesting way to play Battlegrounds. It's just like, ah, I don't know where I am. But then, yeah, so we finished, we died, and then I don't know how yours ended.
It ended with me climbing that hill and then getting shot from multiple directions.
You died on that hill.
I died on that hill. I died on that hill. God. I'm looking at these questions and nothing's jumping. I thought I saw something earlier, but now I'm not. Another correction on Bug Hot. A lot of Bug Hot.
You know, the person who originally sent us Bug Hot apologized and wanted us to know that he actually did, legitimately was studying Japanese, and he was apologized for the mistake.
That's good.
He was very nice about it.
He wasn't just hoisting us.
Okay. He was very nice about it. Thank you.
This one actually comes in from David, Dave, care of Toronto. Who says, hey, y'all, I'm playing through Uncharted 3 after finishing Breath of the Wild. This particular game came to me through a friend. I've never played a game that I enjoyed so much while also thinking it aggressively despised player input. I just finished a sequence where I could beat a man within an inch of his life at the end of a plane's gangway. The plane is in flight. But I could only finish the sequence by running up the gangway and releasing a piece of cargo to knock the gentleman out of the plane. It was wholly unacceptable that I should simply just throw him off the plane.
Austin, did you write this question?
The throwing of dudes into or against objects, something that I've done many times before. I love the characters, the cinematography, and much of the encounter design, but I often feel as though sequences are limited in their interactivity so as to showcase the ideas of the creators to the detriment of player input. Have you ever played a game that felt hostile to your input as a player, but somehow you kept playing? I'm not going to answer this question because everyone knows it's just The Last of Us. But I actually briefly, just to connect this back to the donkey thing, I think like, you knowing that this sounds like me, us knowing that Danielle loves action platformers that have exploration, like, this is the future of game journalism that is about individual voices and having a kind of an oeuvre and a collection, like a knowable, subjective system of taste. I think we're
doing
all right
job with
that.
And knowing that Rob likes to hurt himself.
Rob likes to hurt himself.
Long-term
generally,
strategy games.
But especially with long-term strategy games that take a lot out of him. Like, yeah, this is a very Austin Walker-esque thing. This is like, oh, yeah, this is a good question to read out loud. It says the thing I believe. is there something else where, like, y'all have hit a point where it's like, man, this sucks, but I love enough about this thing to push forward?
What
comes to mind?
Yes. First, I would just say that he or she – it's David. Okay. Definitely – coming to Uncharted at the wrong time right after Breath of the Wild.
Oh,
if they're feeling limited
hard.
In that way, because Breath of the Wild really is a pretty expressive game that does let you approach things in many different ways and lets you completely fuck around the entire
time.
Totally.
There was that speed run during AGDQ, or there was SGDQ.
Orchestra.
Well, yeah, Orchestra, who's great.
Yes.
It was like 40-minute long.
Around 45-minute long.
Physics breaks and stuff like that, which is rad.
It's pretty incredible stuff.
So what's the game that comes to mind for you that where this happened?
Come back to me. This is a familiar feeling.
I'm looking through lists of games where I'm trying to think of
You're
where
to feel
I
feel one out. Rob, do you have one?
Yeah, I mean, like, but it's tough to think. Like, this is kind of a nuance. Like, games that I actually didn't like, but they felt hostile to me.
Games that you did like, but felt hostile to you. Games that you pushed through. The specific question is like, have you ever played through a game that felt hostile to your input as a player, but somehow you kept playing? Like, specifically, Dave loves the characters, the cinematography, and all that other stuff. Whereas, you know, for me, I often sometimes didn't even like that stuff when I played through some of those games.
Biggest Uncharted fan right here. Austin Uncharted Walker.
There are games that I can recognize the quality of, and I just know that I have taste that's my taste, and, like, that's tough.
I feel that way about The Godfather, so don't feel bad.
You feel that way about The Godfather?
I do.
The whole...
Wait, the game or the novel or
the
films?
The films.
Huh.
Beautifully crafted. Impeccably crafted. Doesn't do a damn thing for me. Not my thing. And now I will never live it down.
No, that's fine. I'll defend your right to not The Godfather films. You're disappointing my father, who's listening, who's a big Godfather
really
fan
sorry.
And loves you.
Austin's
and he's just
dead.
Like,
oh, I'm sorry.
That Danielle,
it.
I guess.
Loved you. I mean,
right.
Not anymore.
Yeah.
Like a brother.
I'm going for
like
a short walk off a long pier now after this one.
Oh, you know what? I can think of a game from this. I'm looking through. I keep a list of all the games I play every year. So it's useful for these sorts of discussions.
Yes.
And one that came to mind was Soma from a couple of years ago.
Oh, totally.
So it's from the developers of Amnesia: The Dark Descent.
Yep.
Soma was their sort of underwater horror game from a couple of years back. in which they took what they did in Amnesia, which is like, hey, you don't have weapons, you're going to run from enemies, and we're going to set you in a hostile environment and kind of play mind tricks on you. And they made like a much bigger budget version of that. And that game has an incredible story that so many more people should have experienced and been angry about because it is such a bummer and leaves you in such a dark,
so good,
terrible place by the end. But the monsters are no fun to dodge, to poke around. Like, the trick they set up in Amnesia the Dark Descent did not work a second time. Like, they did not give the player the kinds of tools you needed to enjoy the hiding, the stealth. Like, that part did not evolve in the way it needed to. And so I played that game on the strength of its environment, on the strength of its story, on the strength of the world building it was doing. And I was dealing with the monsters because they were in my way to get to all that other stuff. There were moments where it worked. There were moments that I enjoyed where it came together. But by and large, I would say like that game's like one of its main conceits is like dodge the monsters.
It's
like
bad.
Didn't work for
it's
me
so frustrating.
At all.
Yeah.
And the developers have since actually said, yeah, like maybe we shouldn't have done that a second time.
Did they
not
add?
Do
did
that
they add a mode or was it a mod? There's something that like let you.
There was a mode that got rid of that stuff. But also developers have since said like we're not going to repeat that trick a third time around, which is smart. And they've recognized it didn't really work in Soma. But that's a game that I felt like I was fighting to get to the stuff that I really enjoyed, and that I wouldn't blame anyone for not putting up with that because it's a lot to put up with unless there's a mod that sort of fixes it, because that game told a really interesting story that was wrapped up in some gameplay that just didn't really click.
To tie this back to the donkey stuff before, the last point I'll make there is that he kind of leaves on this notion that is about how games are supposed to be fun. Like, and that there is so much focus on in reviews on story and art and animation and music, but fundamentally, is this thing fun to play? And that is the thing that I most hope that YouTube, that not YouTube, that criticism, games criticism in general continues to work out of.
Yeah.
Because the reasons that you liked Soma and played Soma were not it's a fun game to play in the moment, or rather we've blown
or
up
fun,
the
fun
word
is a much
fun.
Broader yes, term
exactly.
than what we
that story,
normally think of as fun.
Characters. What we mean is like some – we mean enjoyment. We mean pleasure, and pleasure is incredibly broad so that it can include like thoughtfulness and frustration and sadness can all be enjoyable things. Even though they're not necessarily what you think of when you hear the word fun. Fun is just like such a lacking word for what we mean there. And I wish that that's like the one – that was like the one thing that stuck in me that was like I actually can't find any defense for that position at this point because so many games are so powerful and good despite not necessarily being fun to play. So that's
– It's not just a roller coaster. There's a whole lot of other rides that it could be and experience.
Do you like have like amusement park rides that are not –
Well, like, you can think
what
of...
What sort of depressing amusement park rides do you have in mind?
You can think of... All right,
well, who likes the rides looking... where you just go in a circle, like the teacup ride? Like, that just makes you want to throw up. None of that's fun.
Yeah, none of that's fun. Fuck that ride, actually.
But you don't get a broader experience. What about, like, interactive theater that's sort of part of theme parks, too? You can appreciate the architecture. You can appreciate the different aspects.
Yeah,
it's not just
you.
Being on a roller coaster.
Okay.
I'm working on
You're working.
It.
Keep
I'm
working,
working
on,
this. On that one.
Keep
all right.
working on this.
All right.
Any other answers for games that you pushed through despite
I mean, The Last of Us is like that for me.
Yeah,
you know, I know you're, it's yours
but,
as well.
But no,
but,
you're allowed to. It's,
but
I can
for sure. I was very frustrated.
I want there to be a voice that says, I really liked The Last of Us.
I really liked The Last of Us for what I liked of it.
I liked all parts of The Last of Us.
That's I'm glad for you.
I found a lot of the combat frustrating.
I'm right there
I
with you.
I actually liked the combat. I actually liked the physicality of the combat.
I liked the stealth.
Okay,
oh, you don't like it when monsters turn around on you?
Can you
Guess
hey,
what?
Tim, can
monsters
you hit the button that disconnects Rob from the call, actually? That would be good. Oxenfree is mine.
Okay,
because I actually think I didn't like interacting with that game in any way. I didn't like moving through the world.
Sure.
I think that the most interesting story stuff is its collectibles that are spread throughout the world that you've like – walk back through. It's like a pain in the ass, and I still thought that the high points were enough for me to push through it.
So this is kind of random, but there's this game called Take on Helicopters, made by Bohemia Interactive, the Arma 3 studio, but they made this helicopter sim game called Take on Helicopters, and it's got a really interesting campaign. Basically,
it's got
you
good
are
box
just
art too.
A couple blue collar civilian helicopter. You're from this family of civilian helicopter pilots in the Pacific Northwest, and the business is dying, and you sort of come back from the Army where you were a helicopter pilot to take over the business and to take on helicopters doing the various civilian activities.
Yeah, of course.
It's actually got some interesting things going on in it. It had an interesting glitch that I did not know Sims well enough at the time. Like, I thought this was a glitch I thought was normal, and that I was just a really bad pilot. When that game launched, it had really bad ground effect turbulence from your rotor wash.
Oh, no.
As a helicopter gets closer to the ground, the air being disturbed by your rotors is going to disturb the flight characteristics of the helicopter.
Right.
Okay, fine. In this game, when it came out, that effect was so amplified that as you tried to land, your helicopter would start rocketing wildly back and forth and would sometimes tip itself onto its side and explode 2 feet off the ground. And so what I learned
That's
you had
problem.
To do... Yeah, a big problem.
Sorry,
and so I was
customers.
Like, oh, I didn't know helicopters worked this way. I guess the thing to do then is to basically hover about 50 feet off the ground and you just cut the engines. Because that's the only safe way to come down. If you're in a nice like level, nice level hover, you just come down hard. And so it was great because you'll
like
have
a
these
real
character,
helicopter.
You'll have these character interactions where you're like, you know, flying around with your brother or something. You're like really working through some family shit. But the characters also react to what's happening in the helicopter. So like your brother would be like, yeah, I guess I never really did understand, Dad. Well, we still have a chance to put things right. And that's when I cut the rotors and drop like 30 feet. And the thing just hammers the ground. The wheels like break off. And your brother's just like, holy shit, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And that was every mission. Like every mission ended with basically like a controlled crash landing. And I was just like, man, helicopters are tricky.
I guess
this is how they work.
I'm just very upset. That I just did a search for Take On Helicopters, Take On Me. There's no Take On Helicopters, Take On Me music video out there.
And Rock Paper Shotgun
Let's
for sure
that.
Did that.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you, Rock Paper Shotgun, for lifting the heavy rocks.
For lifting the helicopter
and then dropping
of discourse
it on the ground.
And then dropping it.
You can find everything we do here at waypoint.vice.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice. Follow all of our videos at youtube.com/waypointvice. You can find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker. Danielle, what about you?
Danielle R.I.
Rob Zachney.
At Rob Zachney.
Patrick Klepek.
Still asleep. She got up again for a second.
Nice.
Still asleep. Nice. Good job, Jessica.
And she's just trying to lull Rob
into
a false sense of security.
That's what she really do.
Exactly.
Yeah, you can find me at Patrick Klepek.
Shout out to Tim Barnes, who's... What? Rob?
Nothing. Just Nick, if you're still watching this, sounds like a good plan. We'll do it tonight.
Okay, so was that a message to
this
actually
whole
Nick?
Podcast.
Or was that a message to a third party who Rob is trying to trick into thinking now he's working with
Code
Nick?
Codename Nick.
Codename Nick.
Yeah.
Who knows? Maybe Nick stands for something. N.I.C.K.
Night Intra Cooperation Councilman.
Oh, shit. It's Cameron. Cameron's actually the one that he's actually allying with.
Oh, my God.
Shout out to Tim Barnes, who's editing the podcast. Find Tim on Twitter at Tim Barnes 451. Shout out to Natalie, who is running our boards on Twitch. You can find Bowen, who gives us the song Miss You as our theme song off the EP Pale Machine at waypoint.zone/BOEN. That's going to do it for us. We'll be back on tomorrow morning for more Breakfast and Battlegrounds, Wednesday probably for another permadeath.
Yeah.
And then Friday for more Waypoint Radio. Until then, what is it we say to them, Danielle?
Be good or be good at it.
Peace.